Good morning. I'm going to keep talking about Ryaka Fusatz, the full moon ceremony. Last time I gave a lecture, I talked about it, I talked about repentance. So this time we're going to talk about the next section, which is called the homages. And if you want to see the first lecture, it's on YouTube, as well as the audios on our website. So this section of the Bodhisattva ceremony is making homages to the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the ancestors. And also I would say it's paying homage to our true nature. So what I want to talk about is the meaning of each one of the Bodhisattvas and Buddhas that are mentioned and how they are also an aspect of ourselves. First of all, though, what is the meaning of to say to make homage? So synonyms for this word are respect, recognition, admiration, esteem, adulation, acclaim, honor, reverence, tribute, and acknowledgement. So I think all of those things are going on here. And interestingly enough, the historical meaning of to say to make homage has to do with a formal public acknowledgement, which is true of the first part as well, but a formal public acknowledgement of a kind of filial allegiance or looking to our elders for guidance. And I would say that as children of the Buddha, we make our best effort to follow the path. In this case, we do it in this ceremony by professing, making homage, and taking the precepts again. So here, I think, is the meaning of homage for us, is that as followers of the Buddha way, we are renewing through our homage, through the ceremony itself, our dedication, our kind of filial allegiance, if you will, to the Buddha ancestors. So unfortunately, I can't spend a lot of time talking about each one of these things because it would be turned into a workshop rather than a 30-minute lecture. So I'm going to go over this stuff pretty well, but my hope is that we can be inspired and imagine this experience and the power of this section of the ceremony. So I want to talk about each one of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ancestors as a group, their kind of mythology, their attributes, and how they, I think, relate to aspects of ourself. So the first part of the ceremony is, first we did the repentance, which you recall is all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So this next section, the homages, is homage to the seven Buddhas before Buddha, homage to Shakyamuni Buddha, homage to Maitreya Buddha, homage to Manjushri Bodhisattva, homage to Samandrapadra Bodhisattva, homage to Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, and finally, homage to the succession of ancestors. So first one is homage to the seven Buddhas before Buddhas. So in Buddhist mythology, there are seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, although Shakyamuni Buddha is the last of the Buddhas on this list. So the names of the seven Buddhas before Buddha are Vipassi, Sikhi, Vasabhu, Kakusanda, Konagamanda, Kasapa, and Gotama. So those are the seven Buddhas. And they are archetypal Buddhas. All of them have exactly the same kind of life experience. All of them have the same spiritual progress. And for example, all of them are enlightened by sitting under a Bodhi tree. So you could say these are Buddhas all the way down throughout past, present, and future. They are just there. They have always been there. The seven Buddhas before Buddhas are also associated with what we call the pure precepts, or the verse of the common precepts of the seven Buddhas, which all of us who've taken the precepts are familiar with, and we call them the three pure precepts. Not doing evil, practicing good, purifying one's mind. And then usually what we don't say is, this is the teaching of the Buddhas, which is where this connection comes in with the seven Buddhas before Buddha. And Dogen says, in the fast school, Shoaku Musaku, do no evil, he wrote about the three pure precepts, the common precept of our ancestors, the seven Buddhas, is directly transmitted from prior Buddhas to later Buddhas. These precepts are not just of the seven Buddhas. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. So here he's making this connection between the precepts as being a primary, and he's saying the primary teaching of the Buddhas. So all of these homages to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the ancestors, all of these various named Bodhisattvas and Buddhas are associated with the precepts. And probably that's why they're here. So, we are calling them forth. When we make homage, we are calling them forth to witness this ceremony, to witness our public taking of the precepts. They are here to support us. It's kind of like Vimalakirti's room. All these Bodhisattvas and Buddhas are packing in here all over the world every time the Bodhisattva ceremony is performed. They come, and they witness, and they support. They are, in one version of the priest ordination ceremony, when the homages are done, it says, the Buddhas are witness and spiritual teachers. The Bodhisattvas are our fellow practitioners. So the Buddhas are witness and spiritual teachers, and the Bodhisattvas are our fellow practitioners. So we're calling forth all these Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and ancestors to witness, to support us. And we, as we reaffirm our preceptual vows at the end of the ceremony. So actually taking of the precepts at the end of the ceremony is kind of the climax of the ceremony. It's not something that's tacked on to the end of it. So all of these beings that come forth in this ceremony can be also viewed as aspects of the self. So we can think of these seven Buddhas as our basic nature, Buddha nature, the whole of reality's functioning. We call this the foundational isness or suchness of reality. We call this forth to join us in the ceremony. Of course, we're calling forth what already is, which is our true nature. And the true nature of everything. Therefore, what we are calling forth is already us as ourself, and also us universal, us as all being and as family. We recall, we remember, we bring together and bring forth our true nature. We call forth our true nature. So these Buddhas, seven Buddhas before Buddhas, they represent the shared activity of the universe's process within the context of each particular thing or being. So in this way, as are all seven Buddhas as they awaken, we are all the same. Our Buddha nature-ness, if you will, is not different. And at the same time, all of these seven Buddhas are mentioned by name. They all have names. They all have their own Buddha fields. They all have their own particular tree under which they were enlightened. And yet, they are simultaneously just Buddhas and ancestors all the way down, without beginning or with end. So we and they are both universal and particular simultaneously. So the first of the named homages is Shakyamuni Buddha. So we know that Shakyamuni Buddha is the Buddha associated with our world system, the Saha world. You know, he's our guy. He's our Buddha. So historians believe that Shakyamuni Buddha was a real person. But the historical aspect in this case, from a spiritual point of view, is not really important. What is important is how his life inspires us and reflects back to us our own experience as human beings, our own life's path, So from the perspective of our lineage, he's the beginning of our lineage stories. He's gone before us. He's shown us through his life story how to mature in practice. Shakyamuni Buddha's life is essentially a general outline of the spiritual journey. And often when his life is taught, that's what it is that we talk about from a practitioner's point of view. So I kind of wanted to list what those different aspects generally are. And this has been listed by many spiritual traditions, including, of course, Joseph Campbell's famous The Hero's Journey. So the first one is that we have this awareness that something is amiss, that there's more to life than what we are experiencing. That brings about a desire to explore and meet those difficulties and trials. We go on a quest for a better understanding of life itself and our place in this life, and we look for a teacher or for teachings that will guide us to give us a kind of shape and form of how we enter into this new exploration. So we get an idea, we begin to form an idea of a better way with the support of these teachings and this community and a teacher or teachers, and we find a path that seems wholesome and appropriate for us, and we stay on that path. That's an important key place here, is that we stay and follow this path. This requires courage. It requires faith. And through this path of practice, we learn about ourselves and our place within this mandala of life. And then finally, in our tradition, in the 10 Oxfording pictures, we go back to the marketplace with gift bestowing hands. But that's that aspect of maturity. So this final step is the step of giving back. So we do this. We do this as parents. We do this as friends. We do this as in our lives in various situations. We do it at work. This bringing back this wisdom. So we go back into the marketplace and we practice our understanding. And it's done not as an introspective practice, but as a helping, supporting others. This kind of maturity. It's active in the world. So that's how we can think about Shakyamuni Buddha. We are calling forth that aspect of our lives, that spiritual path, when we call forth and say homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. The next homage is with homage to Maitreya Buddha. Who is Maitreya Buddha? Maitreya Buddha is the future Buddha. He is Shakyamuni's successor. He's also known by the name Anjita, which means unconquerable bodhisattva. So now we have talked about the past, the seven Buddhas before Buddha. We've talked about the present, yet physically gone Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and the future Buddha, Maitreya. So Maitreya in Sanskrit, or Metta in Pali, means loving kindness. Right now, Maitreya is in Tusita Heaven, which is where Shakyamuni Buddha hung out before he was reborn as Shakyamuni Buddha. So he's waiting in Tusita Heaven for his time to appear, which will not be for quite a while. It certainly won't be in our lifetime, because he can only appear when there is absolutely no vestige of the Dharma left in this world, which is said to take hundreds and thousands and billions of chilikosms of time. In Shan, Shakyamuni Buddha gave his okesa to Mahakashapa, who was his main disciple, to keep for Maitreya. So Mahakashapa is waiting for Maitreya's appearance inside the mountain called Kukutapapara. So that's where Mahakashapa is. I'm laughing because Shaku's laughing. So he's keeping this golden robe for Maitreya Buddha when he appears. And when Maitreya appears with his golden okesa that he receives, he will, all beings will be enlightened through the precepts, and their lifespans will be 80,000 years. So he teaches the precepts, people wake up, their lifespan is very, very long compared to ours. And we have here another connection between the names we chant in the ceremony and the precepts itself. So the archetype for us, I would say, is that when we are in accord with our life, and we are leading with our Buddha mind, our Buddha nature, we respond with realized action. Our basic nature is metta, our compassion. And no matter how many times we fall down, Maitreya is still standing next to us. Our own true nature will never abandon us. We can think of this as our Buddha nature looking over us, waiting to come forth as we mature in practice. So I would suggest that that is one of the ways that we can think about when we make homage to Maitreya Buddha. So the next two Buddhas are Bodhisattva Sarsamantabhadra and Avalokiteshvara. Interestingly, there is a trinity called, in Japanese, called Sanzan Shaka, which is wisdom, active practice, and compassion. And the iconography of this in East Asian Buddhism is of Shakyamuni Buddha flanked by Manjushri and Samandrapadra. So, taken together, they represent the fully enacted Buddha mind or heart. So again, we had Maitreya Buddha. Next Buddha is Manjushri Bodhisattva. So we have Manjushri, and we have Samandrapadra and Shakyamuni together making up this trinity of the San, Zan, Shakya. So Manjushri Buddha is the Bodhisattva of wisdom, of doctrine and awareness. So Manjushri is wisdom, doctrine, and awareness. Samandrapadra is associated with practice and meditation. And in Chinese Buddhism, Samandrapadra is associated with wisdom action. And Samandrapadra, if you've seen the some of the iconography of him, he's flying on a white elephant. And we call Samandrapadra, in another ceremony, we say he is the Bodhisattva of shining practice. Bodhisattva of shining practice. So the three of, in this trinity here, the three of them together can represent these three important aspects of practice: wisdom, active practice, and compassion. And then the last of the bodhisattvas here is Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. So if we add Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva to Manjushri as wisdom, Samandrapadra, practice, shining practice, and Avalokiteshvara, representing compassion, we have another set of three, which are the components of active practice, the components of the Bodhisattva practice. We say homage to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, also known as Kanon, Chenrezi, various names. So when Kanon, or Avalokiteshvara, is added to this, we have Shakyamuni as our foundational model for practice, for the path of practice. And we also have these aspects which create this active Bodhisattva response. So all three of these aspects, compassion, wisdom, and active practice, are necessary for us to enact our Buddha nature. Shakyamuni represents the whole of our practice manifest. Manjushri is our deep understanding that we do not function separately from the whole of our life. Wisdom is lack of inherent existence, interconnection, causal relationship. We are not separate. We are part of the whole of life as a whole. Alokiteshvara is the cultivation of empathy and discerning emotional connection with our and others' lives together. This discernment of this empathy, this compassion. And when we put it all together and we function from this place of really being able to practice the no-self of interconnection and that empathy and compassion as all beings together, we have a fully enacted practice. We have this shining practice embodied by Samantabhadra. So if we call forth, in this ceremony, we call forth these archetypes of our true nature to stand with us, to function through and as us. The aspect of ourself and other working together is important. The bodhisattvas both function as ourselves, as all being, and as other beings, as the whole beingness of life together. So we make this effort ourselves, and yet we also rely upon and have faith in the efficaciousness and altruistic practice of ourselves and others together. We can't do it by ourselves. So this calling forth of the bodhisattvas is calling forth these various aspects of ourselves and aspects of others as well to come forward and stand with us and be with us, support us. Remember who we are. Remember our true nature. And of course, you can also imagine the bodhisattvas not just as aspects of yourself, but also as beings who come forth and stand with you. Dogen has this great part in Uji where he talks about the devas on your right and left, that they come forth and they stand with us and support our practice. The last one of these is the succession of ancestors, homage to the succession of ancestors. So this is our Zen lineage, which is the source of many stories, koan stories, and other stories about students and teachers working together, studying together. I would say from a spiritual and mythological point of view, we think of these people as our family, that they came before us. They're our grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers and grand-aunts and grandmothers and great-great-great female and male ancestors in our family. And we know their stories, and these stories become the embodiment of our lineage in Zen. So at Ocean Gate, before the pandemic happened, on Thursdays, we would chant the lineage, the formal lineage of the Soto Zen school, all the way down through what is essentially our temple lineage, all the way down through Suzuki Roshi. And we tell stories about Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi is part of the succession of ancestors. So the ancestors are very important to us. They give us courage. They give us guidance. There's a story about Suzuki Roshi where he said, supposedly said, "I am afraid to die." The fact that he was willing to admit that brings courage to us in our own struggle with impermanence and change. So he is part of our ancestral lineage and very much alive for us. So we bring forth, when we say the successions of ancestors, we are bringing forth the whole of our lineage, bringing it forth, asking it to come, be here. We recognize who is recognized, and we recognize all that we do not know. We recognize all of the men and women who have practiced Zen throughout space and time, in memorial, and we know and remember them and bring them forth to come and occupy this place with us, to support us and bear witness to the vow that we take the precepts. And a very important aspect of the ceremony is bowing, prostrations, which I talked about last time as well. Here's what Dogen said about bowing and about prostrations. He said, these ritual procedures have been handed down from afar from the seven Buddhas. These are the seven Buddhas before Buddha. Their essential point has been directly transmitted to us. For this reason, we follow these procedures. We should recognize that bowing is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. These ritual procedures have been handed down from afar from the seven Buddhas. He's suggesting here, he's not necessarily talking about the Ryakufisat ceremony, but he's saying these ceremonies and procedures, these forms, these things that we do in practice, these have been handed down through the lineage from the seven Buddhas. Their essential point, the key aspect of these rituals, if you will, have been directly transmitted to us. So this is a heart practice. This is not a practice of some kind of rote ritual that we engage in. This is a deep yoga of heart and mind. He said, for this reason, we follow these ceremonies and we should recognize that bowing is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. In other words, bowing embodies the whole kit and caboodle of our practice. We bow enacting the whole of our practice. And this bowing softens our body and minds. Now, I would say that for some of us, many of us, as we get older or for other physical reasons, we may not be able to do full prostrations. But this doesn't matter. If we sincerely put our hands in gassho and lower ourselves from the waist or even just from the head, that's enough, as long as it is done with a sincere and open heart. So I thought I would end this lecture by telling you a story that I lived in Japan when I was a kid, and this is a story. I remember I had a little picture book of the story, and here's the story. So in Japan, there are these creatures called kappa, and kappa are a kind of amphibious demon or trickster found in rivers, and they have webbed hands and feet, but they have human-like bodies. And they have turtle shells on their back. And they also have these little dishes in the top of their head that hold water, which is really important because if they don't have their water in the top of their head, they are very weakened and can die over time if they don't have their water. The other thing about kappa is they are known as being prodigious farters. So the interesting thing about kappas is that they are also super, super polite, and they really believe in the importance of etiquette. So if a kappa confronts you, these tricksters, they've come out of the water, you're, you know, just taking a walk, there you are, going along, all of a sudden one of these kappa pops up out of the river. And what to do, because they're tricksters, and they will kind of do bad things. The way that you work with a kappa is that you get very polite with them because they have to respond to your politeness. So if you bow to a kappa, they must bow back. And when this happens, if you bow deeply enough, the kappa has to respond with a bow as deep as your bow, and the water in the dish, in their head, comes out, which is a problem for the kappa. So, if you help the kappa by refilling the water in the bowl on its head, go and you get the water and you put it back in its head, then it will no longer be a threat to you. It will be tamed, if you will, by your generosity. So, you know, we have our own kappa nature. And we have this kind of trickster side that's very wily. And sometimes we do these ceremonies and we say to ourselves, why should I bow? Am I bowing to the Buddha statue? Is this some kind of cult? Some kind of worshiping of idols when I bow? So there's this part of us where we say, I don't like these ceremonies. I don't want to do this stuff. But you know, if we bow, something interesting happens to that trickster side of us. So I think we're like this kapha. So we feel like we might be diminished by that bowing or humbling ourselves to something outside of our own way. So we want to hold on to our own way. We don't want to do these other things. But if we do it because that's what's happening, that's the etiquette of, let's say, the lineage that we're in, we're kind of like the kapha. At that point, we have to return the bows. Oh my God, we're stuck in the Zendo. They're doing the Bodhisattva ceremony. I guess I'll just have to do it too. And so we find ourselves returning these bows. And by tipping our heads, we become vulnerable. We become humble. We are open. We are open to the ceremony, and we will have our efforts supported and our spirits replenished. Water will be returned to us. So if we call forth, when we call forth the seven Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the ancestors, when we pay homage to the lineage and to each aspect of ourselves as well, and to others manifesting and witnessing, then there's a magic here that happens. We may not know right away, but this ceremony is like this, and it's transformative. Thank you.